Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Nina Simons. She is co-founder and co-CEO of Bioneers. Her latest book is called Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. She's the editor of a compilation of essays about women's leadership. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Now, women's leadership, how does that differ from leadership?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, when I put together the book Moonrise, what I found was that it was important to me that the book includes some men as well. So I don't think it's only about women's leadership. I think about women's leadership from a whole systems approach. And what that means to me is that it's simultaneously about how we as human beings need to reclaim all of our human qualities that have been associated with the feminine and have therefore been devalued and diminished in our value system. And it's also about women. And around the world, women's leadership is ascendant. You know, it's happening in many, many countries. And interestingly, study after study is finding that as women get more involved in leadership, in business, in governance, and in civil society, what happens is that there are cascading benefits to the society, that the environment improves, the social equity improves, the peacemaking improves. And so the Pentagon has actually adopted it as a new measure. When they look at the stability of any region in the world, they actually count how many girls' schools there are in the region as one of their benchmarks.
It's almost ironic that the Pentagon would be adopting that, given that the leadership within the military is, I mean, it's such a male system.
I think it's super ironic. I mean, it's, you know, but the world is filled with those sort of dichotomies and ironies. And my sense is that we're watching very large patriarchal systems sort of crumbling of their own weight, but at the same time beating their chest in a sort of Godzilla way. And at the same time, there are different forms of leadership that are emergent and that I think hold great promise for really shifting our direction toward a future that's life-affirming and peaceful and just.
One of the essays in the book, Moonrise, is by a woman who had decision-making, a pretty high level of employment in the U.S. Forest Service, and she was really one of the few women ever in that position, perhaps the first in her region or in the country. And there was a piece of national forest which they were going to open up for oil and gas drilling, and she went through a whole process and involved, you know, the entire community and listened to everybody's point of view on the thing, and eventually made the decision that this was far too important a piece of wilderness to allow to be ruined. And what was fascinating to me about it was not only that she involved a lot of criteria besides economic and that kind of industrial pressure, but that when that decision was made, instead of getting a really angry backlash from her colleagues, they applauded her for doing it. And I got the sense reading that essay that the men, her colleagues, kind of wished that they could think the way she did and make the kind of decision she did. It's very interesting.
It is. It's very interesting. I mean, I think, you know, I would be hesitant to oversimplify the impacts of her decision because I think she got negative fallout as well. But
from industry.
From industry and even from some folks in the Forest Service, you know, but certainly her constituencies, the people she was in public service to were so grateful. And I mean, it's part of what I loved about putting together the book is that there are examples of women and men in every sector and in every industry who have made decisions using different criteria and different parts of their intelligence than we have conventionally been trained to rely on. And I think, you know, what's emerging, what was really what motivated me to put together the book was the question, if I can scan across all these examples of amazing leadership across sectors, what will it teach me about how leadership is changing? Not only for women, but how is the rise of women's leadership changing what we understand leadership to be, and what's important to focus on in leadership? And you know, I think as you describe with that woman whose name was Gloria Flora, I mean, they're kind of sheroes in every different domain.
Sheroes.
Yeah, that's how I think of them. They're people who I look to as my teachers, and who have been willing to take pretty significant risks in order to really redefine the rules of the game.
So when you say how is women's leadership changing, and when you ask what is leadership, what have you come up with?
Well, you know, I'm coming up with very different kinds of definitions than I feel like I had been trained to look toward. I think, you know, rather than a conventional view that leadership is the smartest person in the class who stands at the front, who's really eloquent, and who can inspire people with their you know, verbiage, what I found is that women are leading from all kinds of positions, and people can lead from behind and within a group, that there are introvert leaders as well as extrovert leaders, that there are leaders who, you know, come up with a particular slant of a way of seeing things that can shift the orientation of a whole movement, and that there is a quiet kind of leadership that we haven't been trained to look for. And, you know, one of the things that I've found as I've been going around and talking about the book is that sometimes women will show up who are mothers, and they say, well, I can't be a leader, I'm a mom. And it's stunned.
Or as you don't hear, I can't be a leadership, I'm a dad.
Well, exactly. And it's stunned me, because what I've realized is I'm not a mother, and I look at mothering as one of the most expansive, stretchy, difficult, challenging forms of leadership that I can imagine, right? And parenting in general, but mothering in its own way, you know, is an extraordinary act of leadership. And who's bringing up the next generation? So the fact that we have this split in our minds between, you know, mothering and raising a family and leadership is something I think we need to look at, because I think women have been leading as long as humans have been alive on the planet. And the fact that we don't consider mothering to be leadership is sort of a crazy thing. But a lot of what I found in the book too, Mary Charlotte, is that part of the inherited definition that I had of leadership is that it's a solo activity. And that a lot of the women and men who are in the book are leading in collaboration. And they're leading in ways that leverage the best thinking of the whole, and that really connect, that have the power of connecting across differences, which is not an easy thing. But
what does that look like? What's an example of that?
Well, an example of that, and this is something that we actually work on in a very intentional way in our Cultivating Women's Leadership intensives, is that our culture tends to be informed by a divide-and-conquer sort of mentality that tends to keep people of separate classes, of separate cultures and races, and of separate generations distinct and apart. And so part of what we do is based on the assumption that one of the most important skills we can bring to leadership is the capacity to intentionally reach somebody who was raised in a pueblo and has a completely different worldview and traditional sensibility than I might, having been a Jewish woman raised in New York. And how do I choose to respectfully partner with that person in a way that assumes equal ground, in a way that assumes that I have as much to learn from them as they might have from me, and that sort of quells the tendency toward arrogance that I think comes with being a woman with white skin in this country, that privileges having white skin. So it means, you know, it means that there's a group called the Women's Earth Alliance, and there are about six or seven multicultural leaders who are collaborating very intentionally to develop the programs that they lead, both in Indian country and this country, and also around the world. It means choosing to work with people who are different than you, and then finding ways to strengthen that collaboration and to work through the challenges that arise, which of course they will.
We're talking to Nina Simons about women's leadership. Now, there's a section in the book where you yourself, I think, talk about the burning times and the millions of women who were basically killed or burned at the stake for being witches, and these were essentially the female leaders of their time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I cite that story because for me that was the source of an epiphany. Up until that point, I had never really identified myself much with being a woman. I had sort of grown up in the aftermath of the first wave of the feminist movement, and I found that growing up in the 60s and 70s, those women were really not appealing to me. I found them angry, you know, I found them polarizing, and I didn't want to be anything like them. But I did sort of assume that I was the beneficiary of their work. And in a way, it was startling to me in my 20s and 30s to discover that I was not stepping onto an equal playing field. And that in fact, you know, in business and civil society, I was meeting challenges where I was the only woman on an all-male board. And, you know, I would raise ideas and they would be ignored until the man sitting next to me would say the same thing and then be applauded.
Is there any woman listening to the show right now who has not had that experience, ladies and gentlemen?
Right. So I started saying, okay, not an equal playing field. So what do we do about this? And then I saw that film, and it's actually available online. Anybody can...
The Burning Times.
The Burning Times. You can just Google it, and it's about an hour-long film, and it was made almost 20 years ago, so it's a little bit dated. But it tells the story of the 500-year period in European history where somewhere between 50,000 and millions of women were tortured and burned for the supposed crime of being witches. And as you said, they were the women leaders of their time. What happened for me when I saw it was that suddenly this deep fear that had lived inside my bones made some sense to me, because I had never understood why would I be so fearful about speaking my truth in public. Or, you know, I had no idea where that came from. It just didn't make any sense to me.
And you think it came from that?
Well, you know, when I watched it, I thought, God, you know, six or seven generations of children watched as women throughout their community were persecuted and tried. And then I started to research the whole period, and what I found that was really interesting to me, Mary Charlotte, was that all these social systems shifted during the course of that period. So at the beginning of the Burning Times, women had more resources, more money than men in Europe. And by the end, of course, there was a huge transfer of wealth. At the beginning of the Burning Times, women were the midwives and the herbalists and, you know, and helped do hospice when people were really ill or dying. And so women practiced medicine. And by the end of the Burning Times, medicine could only be practiced if you'd been to university, and only men were allowed in university. So medicine shifted from the purview of women to the purview of men. And our whole relationship to the land shifted during that time. It went from a communally based system to what was called the enclosure system. So suddenly there was this privatization and fencing. And of course, in terms of religion and spirituality, it went from a largely female-based spirituality to a largely Christian and male-based, masculine-based.
What time period are we talking about?
We're talking about like 1100 to 1700. And so it was a long period, you know. But when I saw it, I thought, how could, I mean, my lineage is from European descent, and many of us here on this continent now of European descent have ancestors back there. And how, you know, we started calling it the hidden Holocaust of women around my house.
Right.
And I was stunned that something like this could have happened and might not have learned about it in school. I thought, you know, this is giant. How can this not be taught in history?
It's interesting because we're living in a time now where there's been a movement toward hospice and healers and midwives and all that kind of stuff. So we're kind of moving back in that direction, to say the least.
Well, you know, exactly. The big epiphany for me was that all of the things that I had learned about through Bioneers that were both our most challenging environmental and social problems could all be seen as an imbalance of the masculine and the feminine, and an overvaluing of the, quote, masculine traits and an undervaluing of the, quote, feminine traits in us all, not only in women, but in everybody.
And what do you consider, I mean, it's always very, very shaky ground here, what you consider masculine and feminine, because there's, those boundaries are so blurry, really.
Well, and they're changing every day, thankfully. You know,
but I guess... what do you mean when you say that?
Well, what I mean is that in the broadest terms, we tend to associate, quote, masculine with a quiet kind of aggressiveness, with an acting out, right? With an action orientation and a strong sense of focus. We tend to associate, quote, feminine characteristics with emotionality, with embodiment and sensitivity, with a kind of relational intelligence and an awareness of what other people might be thinking or feeling, an empathic awareness. And also, interestingly, you know, science has been proving that female brains are actually biologically better suited for multitasking.
Yes.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, as a mother, any mother would know this, and any household keeper.
I think one of the ironies of this that I've been noticing is the extent to which this so-called, I mean, you didn't exactly put it in this way, but rational man, emotional woman thing is utter and complete nonsense. When you look at the emotional attachment that male politicians, whether they be liberal or conservative or something in between, have to their ideologies, whether it be militarism or the free enterprise system or whatever their thing is, that attachment is absolutely impervious to rationality. It is an utterly emotional attachment.
Well, and I would push back a little and say it's a belief system. You know, we call them BS around our house. It's a belief system. But it is absolutely emotionally attached. And what I've been studying and learning is, you know, ironically, they're finding that in business, one of the hindrances to women's getting promoted into high levels of leadership is our emotionality and our ability to feel. You know, that the fact that a woman will cry in the office means that men around her can't take her seriously and don't think she should be a boss. Well, meanwhile, what I've been learning is that I think we have an emotional language that's accessible to us as human beings that's full of really important information. And what I've been finding is that, you know, our tendency to squelch the, quote, dark emotions, you know, of anger and fear and despair, I believe is really responsible for why we don't have people out in the streets demanding change right now, at a time when the environment and our social systems are basically being assaulted by corporate tyranny, you know, and
here I thought it was because they've militarized the police and marginalized protests.
Well, undoubtedly, it's that too. But, you know, imagine if we could become a population that had some sort of healthy relationship to our own anger. And anger, actually, in its healthy form, is about boundaries. It's about setting boundaries and defending boundaries. And my God, I mean, all of our bodies are being assaulted by 230 exogenous chemicals. You know, we have cancer rates going through the roof. Our boundaries are under assault in so many ways that if we were paying attention and weren't anesthetized and weren't pharmaceuticalized, we might be out there demanding change on a level that would be more effective.
In the book Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart, there's a great essay by Julia Butterfly Hill, who was motivated by a kind of, the way she puts it, just ripping her heart out and stomping on it, kind of anger, fear, and despair about what was happening to the redwood forests. And so she ended up sitting in a tree for a couple of years. And the area that she sat in, albeit small, ended up being preserved as part of a research and forest area that was no longer going to be clear-cut. But what was interesting, I mean, I've always thought she's an incredible example of what direct action driven from the heart can do. But what I didn't realize was how much it hurt to do what she did, both emotionally and physically. I mean, everything from the frostbite to the many, many physical pains of being in a tree for 2 years. But also, she talks about the first 3 months of rage.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we do a lot of work in our intensives. Actually, one of our purposes there is to help women really connect with what calls them most. You know, we call it a sense of purpose or assignment. And some of the exercises we do have to do with really getting in touch with both what you love the most and what angers or hurts you the most. You know, I find that every time I read stories about whales beaching with stomach cancer, I just go crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and dolphin fetuses washing up dead on the Gulf Coast. I mean, it hurts me so personally to read and learn about that. And, you know, but everyone has their own place that breaks your heart open. And you know, when we look at how many people are living in poverty around the world and in this country, how many children don't have enough food to eat or shelter over their heads, it's crazy. And there's a lot of good reason for healthy anger. And, you know, so my sense is we're at this extraordinarily creative moment of reinvention in the world. And it actually calls us all, each in our own way, into leadership. And it's a leadership that I am hopeful we can do without having to sacrifice our bodies or our souls to do it. That, in fact, it's a leadership that also brings incredible fulfillment and joy, even as it demands a great deal of us, you know. And that's part of the paradigm that I'm interested to see change, too, is how can we lead and not kill ourselves?
You know? How's that going for you?
Well, it's mixed, you know.
I mean, you are the co-founder of Bioneers. Why don't you tell us about your story of hooking up with your partner and founding Bioneers and taking leadership and sharing leadership?
Sure. Well, I mean, we started Bioneers when my partner, Kenny Ausubel, who is a journalist and researcher, basically had been discovering all these stories of people who had brilliant solutions to pressing problems, but nobody knew about them. And a funder one day in a hot tub said, "Why don't you have a conference?" And Kenny had never been to a conference. And Kenny said, "Well, why would I do that?" And the guy said, "You know, here's a grant for $10,000. Have a conference." So Kenny came to me and said, "Will you help me produce a conference?" And I had a background in theater and was really interested in how the experience of live theater can actually change people. And but I had also never been to a conference, which in a way was a blessing for both of us because we thought conferences were boring and we didn't want to do anything boring or academic. And so we designed this 3-day gathering to bring together people from all walks of life who had amazing solutions. And you know, it was a massive experiment. We had no idea how it would go. We started it here in Santa Fe in 1990. And what we found was that there was just this amazing experience of everyone coming together. It was like connecting all the parts of a puzzle. And suddenly, there was so much energy and enthusiasm and excitement in the room. And I remember sitting there and thinking, well, this is the community of leaders that I want to serve with my communication skills. And so we kept producing Bioneers for a total of, we've been producing it now for 21 years. But I went through a real revelation in the middle of that. So about 10 years in, when I was turning 40 and I had decided not to have children in this life, I basically made myself a promise that I was going to have myself. And I didn't mean that in any kind of egoic way. I just meant that if there was a purpose that I had been born for, I really needed to find out what it was. And I didn't want to die without living what I was meant to do. And so I started this really deep inquiry. And along the way, someone gave me the assignment of writing my story, the story of my relationship to Bioneers. So I wrote the story, and what I realized was that inwardly I was carrying this story that I was the woman behind the man. That basically for the first 10 years or so of Bioneers, Kenny was the one who was out on stage. He was the one who was moderating. He was selecting many of the speakers. And what I was contributing was sort of the relational glue. I was helping make the stage beautiful. I was doing all the communications and PR work. I was communicating with all of the participants and all of the presenters. And I was sort of helping create the container for something great to happen. And so when I wrote that story and I realized that I saw myself as the woman behind the man, I sort of felt simultaneously disgusted and elated, because I realized that it was an awful story and that I didn't want to live that way. And I also realized that I was the only one who had that story, that Kenny didn't see me that way, and people in the world didn't see me that way. Outwardly, I was starting to get acknowledged for my leadership. And I didn't think I was a leader. I thought I was just putting one foot in front of the other and doing the best I knew how, which is pretty much the way I still see it. But so I set about to change my story. And that was really a big revelation for me. And what I realized as I would share my learning with other women around me was that it seemed like everyone was nodding their heads. And what was startling to me was that I began to realize that it wasn't only women who looked like me who were nodding their heads, but women who were from Native American descent and women who were African American and Hispanic and Latino. And so I began to wonder and think, well, maybe what I'm learning has use value for all kinds of women. And so I contacted my dear friend Toby Hertzlick, who is a brilliant facilitator and change leader, and who had worked a lot with women's groups in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I said, would you help me design a retreat for women and a way for a group of really diverse women to come together and learn from and with each other? And so we've been doing that for 5 years. And I guess in answer to your original question, I feel like I'm practicing something that feels like the both and life. It's like, on the one hand, your original question that I'm remembering is, how are you doing with that not burning out in leadership? I'm stretched very thin at the moment. And between co-leading Bioneers and doing all this work with Moonrise and women's leadership, I've got more on my plate than I would like. Right. And so I'm looking to transition. How do I shift that in a way so that it's more manageable? But at the same time as having more than I'd like, I'm more gratified. I'm more lit up by what I'm doing than I've ever been in my life. And I feel more centered and like I'm bringing all of me to bear and I'm being really well used. And when I'm in those intensive retreats, I'm kind of in a state of ecstasy for 6 days. And that's amazing, you know? And it's, I mean, I wish it for everyone, each in our own ways.
We're talking to Nina Simons about cultivating women's leadership. Her book is called Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about these cultivating women's leadership trainings that are coming up, or intensive workshops. Let's get back for a moment to this question of your narrative of the woman behind the man. I think one of the reasons that a lot of men are successful leaderships is because they have a support system at home. And a lot of women don't have that. In other words, in the more traditional, and it's not that the 1950s defined everything for us in any way, but we do really have a lot of people, particularly men who are making enough of a salary to support a family without the woman working, having a total support structure, which is intellectual, emotional, physical, culinary, laundry. I mean, from top to bottom, they've got somebody who's got their back and is doing stuff for them. Now, very few women that I know have the corresponding thing in reverse. I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody who has a house husband.
Yeah.
And even those people who have a supportive partner, that feeling of that you can really rest and know that somebody's going to cover you, that's very hard for women to have. And so, you know, while from the woman's point of view, it's not that great to be in that, you know, woman behind the man position, from the man's point of view, it's great. And, you know, how can we as women get that kind of support? Can we?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, for me, you know, and frankly, in my partnership and my marriage, it's meant pulling back from some of the things that I had automatically done to support him and us both, and really demanding some mutuality and being met in some of it. But I think there's only so far that you can go with that. And I think there are examples, but they're few and far between, of house husbands. And really, our premise with cultivating women's leadership is we can't do it alone. We need each other. And I think as women in a society that has been designed around separation and factionalization, we get much more training in being competitive with each other than in how to collaborate with each other and how to actually support each other. And so one of the really primary goals of the Cultivating Women's Leadership experience is to have a 5 or 6 day immersion in being with a group of women who authentically and honestly and wholeheartedly are at your back and are really, you know, in support of your best leadership emergence. And that's an amazing feeling. You know, what's been startling to me has been realizing that women of all ages and every level of leadership are gaining a lot from it.
But they're not going to cook for you.
That's true. That's true. And, you know, maybe you make peace with picking up a pizza once or twice a week. You know, I mean, I think some of this is we have to bust the superwoman myth, that we have to be excellent at everything all the time. You know, actually, we're in this reinvention where if we're going to have fulfilling work and, and be homemakers, whatever that might look like, or mothers, then some things are going to have to give, you know. And part of it for me has been, I'm sorry, I can't clean my own house anymore. I just have to pay some people to come in and do it for me, you know, and trust that that doesn't make me a less wonderful human being or woman. So I think, you know, I think it's just got to all be up for review.
The book Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart, has a lot of personal stories in it of people who have, for example, there's a woman named Lily Ye who started a little arts group in a kind of depressed black neighborhood in Philadelphia, and it expanded into unbelievable proportions. I mean, people should get a hold of this book just for that story alone. It's quite amazing. And there are people who are starting organic food movements and people who are doing, like, Julia Butterfly Hill. There's every kind of story. And what I'm struck by is that taken together, you have this almost like infiltration of the society by women who are doing something, thinking differently, bringing a set of values that are more kind of whole person values. But it also strikes me that on the areas that are really, really important, the legislative, the mm-hmm. political, the executive, the military, the mm-hmm. police, those which have the most power over our lives in terms of that kind of raw power to tell you what to do and to detain you and to and so on, we still haven't gotten much.
That's true. That's very, very true. You know, I can tell you a quick story that's kind of wonderful in that regard. For the last 2 years, I've been invited to attend the UN Conference on the Status of Women in New York. And initially, I was invited by Jean Shinoda Bolen, who is, you know, the Jungian author who's written, like, Goddesses and Every Woman. And when she initially invited me, I was kind of simultaneously flattered and skeptical. And I said, well, why would it be worth my time to go? Because I think of the UN as some place where not much happens, really. And she said, Well, your perception is correct in that not much happens, but what does happen is 8,000 women leaders from all over the world coming together, and that's worth going for. And so I went, and what I experienced there was really interesting because I went to session after session, and a lot of the sessions, they're reporting on the progress as measured against the UN Millennial Goals. And the UN Millennial Goals basically are about how many women are in governance, how many, you know, trends, and how many women are in top levels of business. And so I heard one after another women from the EU and from Africa, from all over the world, saying, well, you know, in the last year we've managed to achieve a 0.5% improvement from 2.5 to 3 in the, you know, and I would listen to one after another of these reports and think, I started to feel like, well, we may as well give it up now. Forget it. We don't have this much time. And this is really appalling if this is the only kind of progress that's being made. And then this woman from India got up. And I'm excited because she's coming to speak a plenary at Bioneers this year. And her name is Dr. Pam Rajput. And she got up and she said, well, in India, we decided that rather than working for incremental change, we were going to take a completely other approach. And we decided that although we have 30% women in parliament in India, we were going to create a parliament of women and create a completely alternative structure. And so we began educating women all over India, and throughout the 27 states of India, we held democratic elections. And we elected 530 women from all over India to this alternative parliament. And she said, we didn't ask anyone's permission, we didn't authorize it, we just decided to do it, and we did it. And then we had the 530 women together, and I realized that I needed to teach them parliamentary procedure. And because I'm a political science professor, I thought, okay, so I created a curriculum, and I taught everyone parliamentary procedure. And then we thought, well, what do we do next? Well, we should pass a budget. So we studied budgets all over the world, and we studied all these different ways of designing budgets, and we explored the gross happiness index, and we explored all these different models, and then we passed a budget. And of course, as you might anticipate, our budget defunded militarization and, you know, and defunded large corporations and tax benefits. And of course, we allocated much greater resources to social programs and education and women and girls. And we passed our budget just about 2 weeks before the other parliament was scheduled to meet. And we managed to get some media coverage of it. And we continued to meet and we continued to strengthen our capacity to govern. And now, when a member of parliament dies, they don't have to give his seat to his wife. They have 530 women who are all trained in parliamentary procedure and have already been elected, who they can draw from. And I was sitting on the edge of my seat, just like every hair standing on end, so excited, because it was such an extraordinary example of, you know, when the system's not working, you can chip away at it all you want, or you can create the alternative structure so that when it crumbles, there's something else there.
But, I mean, okay, so their budget, what happened to it?
Well, you know, what happened to it was that it got some media coverage, and it meant that the other parliament actually has somebody to whom they are somewhat accountable. Now, who knows how much? I mean, I don't mean to exaggerate the impact of it. I don't know how to exactly measure the impact of it. When I saw her this past year, she told me that her latest idea is that she wants to create a global parliament of women. Which, frankly, again, I just went, oh my God, what a brilliant idea. That's incredibly exciting. Because part of my premise in the work with Moonrise and with all the women's leadership work that we're doing is that women seem to be both biologically and culturally predisposed toward collaboration and toward reaching across differences at a time when it's what our human species needs most in order to overcome what we're facing. And so, you know, it's just an incredibly exciting idea. And, I mean, you're right. Across the world, both in governance and in militarization and in raw power of business, we're way behind.
Yeah.
And it's slow.
And all the, I mean, I think what is, it's heartening that all these amazing projects on the ground are happening and how utterly marginal they are is discouraging.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, I read the business section pretty carefully, and there are more and more business stories about how women leaders are doing it differently and what are the benefits that women bring to leadership in business and, you know, and in governance. And so I think we're just at a huge turning point, you know.
Well, we know this. We also know what to do about climate change and pollution.
Well, right. And, you know, one of the interesting things to me, Mary Charlotte, has been that a lot of the women's leadership work that's out there tends to focus on the externalities. It tends to focus on, like, dress for success, control your emotions, how to negotiate better, you know. And what I've been finding, at least based on my own experience, is that there's a whole realm of what's holding us back that has to do with our inner programming. And that the more that we can get mindful about liberating ourselves from the stories that hold us back and from the unexamined belief systems that keep us from being in our biggest capacity, that's where the big power lies.
Nina Simons is co-founder and co-CEO of Bioneers. Her book is called Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. She's the editor of that book, which is full of fascinating essays. You can go to bioneers.org to find out more about the book. Part of the book is downloadable, too.
Yeah, I think almost half of it is in a PDF on the site that's free and downloadable, so folks are welcome to go check it out.
And you are having some events called Cultivating Women's Leadership. These are, what, six-day workshops?
They are. They're six-day residential retreats. And they're by application. We're doing two of them, I think, in northern New Mexico this summer, one later in June and one at the end of August. And they're by application. So I would encourage any woman who's interested to go to the Bioneers site because there's all kinds of information there. Quotes from past participants and the online application, which actually we need filled out within the next couple of weeks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So check it out. And people who maybe are not necessarily leaders of organizations should still apply.
Absolutely. I mean, here's the thing. People who are young and have a vision for how they want to make change in the world and may not have a lot of experience at it, as well as folks who are very experienced leaders but maybe at a turning point in their lives. And looking for how to redirect their energies in a way that's really going to help the world and have real meaning for them. And the other thing is, I really want to encourage women to apply who may not have the money to pay for it, who can only come up with a small part of the registration fee. We very actively raise money for scholarships. And we also have a really deep commitment to doing these retreats with at least 30% women of color. And we're doing them for the first time this year with a third facilitator who's a woman of color.
Oh, okay.
And who's just a really amazing woman leader who I'm really excited to work with. Her name is Rachel Bagby, and she's a woman from the East Coast who was originally trained as an attorney and then became a farmer and started a CSA. And her
community-supported agriculture.
Thank you. And her real love is singing. And she's all about changing the world through song and lifting our voice. And so she's an amazing combination of really skillful in multicultural stuff and also exquisitely smart and just deeply wise, you know. So it's exciting. And we're doing one in California that it looks like maybe half white women and half women of color.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nina Simons, Bioneers.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. Great to be with you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program T. Zane Reeves. He is Regents Professor Emeritus of Public Administration at the University of New Mexico. He's a member of the National Academy of Arbitrators and chair of the Rio Rancho School District Labor Board. And he's moderator of the conference Working Together, the Future of Public Employee Collective Bargaining in New Mexico, this Friday, the 6th of May, actually next Friday, the 6th of May, at the Hotel Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great.
So this is a conference which is designed to be basically a big conversation. What's it all about? How did it come about?
Well, keep in mind that it's co-sponsored by the School of Public Administration with the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, which is the only federal agency charged with mediating and arbitrating disputes between unions and management. So it's co-sponsored. And what we want to do is we want to avoid Wisconsin. We don't want what happened in Wisconsin and what is happening in Indiana and Ohio to happen here to, you know, collective bargaining. We want to come up with ideas and concepts to increase cooperation between public sector, public employee unions and management in this state. So that's the idea behind it.
Why don't you define for us what is collective bargaining?
Collective bargaining is always between a union, a group of employees in a bargaining unit, and with management, whoever the management happens to be. And what they do is problem solve. They negotiate to come up with a sometimes it's called a contract, but it's an agreement. And it lists all the issues they resolve in common, and that contract guides their relationship for a year, two, or three, depending on the length of the contract.
What are the main types of issues that come up in collective bargaining negotiations?
The issues have to do with working conditions, conditions of employment, and compensation. And then there are any other issues that the two parties would want to bring up that are voluntary, that they don't have to talk about them, but they're voluntary issues.
Health and safety come up quite often.
Health and safety, child care, break time, all kinds of things come up.
Why do you think that collective bargaining as an institution is under assault in the United States right now?
Well, I don't think it's under assault. I think it's under assault in some states because in the public sector, it varies state by state. Each state takes a different approach to collective bargaining, whereas in the private sector, we have one national set of laws covering all private sector collective bargaining, so it doesn't vary by state. So we in New Mexico don't do collective bargaining for our public employees like they do in Arizona or Ohio, so it varies state by state. And in some states, like Wisconsin and Ohio, it is definitely under assault. I wouldn't use that term to describe New Mexico at all, that's a potential, but that's not the reality here.
As I was preparing to talk to you, I was looking up collective bargaining, and it turns out that collective bargaining is recognized through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a fundamental human right.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And when, for example, in Egypt, when the Mubarak regime started persecuting the labor unions, that is recognized as an affront to human rights. Historically, workers have the right to organize and deal as a group with their employer.
Tell us a little bit about the history of collective bargaining here in New Mexico.
Well, it's a history that a lot of people may not understand or be familiar with, but we're unusual. We've had collective bargaining since the early 70s in New Mexico in certain cities and counties. For example, in Albuquerque, they've had collective bargaining since 1971, and it wasn't because we had a state law. It was because that's what the city of Albuquerque wanted to do. We've had collective bargaining for state employees since about the same time, the late 70s, and that was done by the governor's executive order, and Tony Anaya was very instrumental in doing that. So we've had collective bargaining, but we've not had it as a state law except in more recent times. So as a consequence, almost all employees in Albuquerque and Bernalillo County and in Rio Rancho and other places are represented by unions, and they belong to bargaining units, and they negotiate with management.
And what has that gotten them?
Well, it keeps you out of court, for one thing, because if there isn't a system for resolving disputes, basically, the only alternatives are to strike, go to some sort of coercive means, or to take every issue to court and sue each other. And I certainly don't believe that those are preferable to sitting down and negotiating and problem solving together.
The conference is called Working Together, the Future of Public Employee Collective Bargaining in New Mexico. And for registration, people can go to dce.unm.edu. They can call 505-277-0077. T- T. Zane Reeves, Professor Emeritus of Public Administration at UNM, thanks so much for being with us.
Mary Charlotte, thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.